Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It does sound really creepy and spooky, like you're in the mountains and like you just hear this like coming from the mountains. Sometimes it does remind me of Chewbacca.
I can't really remember when was it the first time I heard Roger Payne's album. It was years ago, maybe even before I went into a science career.
It sounds like one of those, like, you know, wooden xylophone things, like where you get the beating stick and you, like, rub it along and it goes...
But just hearing these sounds for the first time just blew my mind.
Almost sounds like a cat.
And I think that's what happened to many people. Through his album, he brought the sounds from the ocean to people's homes.
Sounds like a Jabberwocky or something.
I had just finished my eighth album, which was called Who Knows Where the Time Goes. Now, this was in 69 when I was starring in this musical of Peer Gynt. And we were performing in the park. And this is a beautiful theater in New York City, the Shakespeare Theater, it's called. And people would come backstage after the show. A lot of times it was friends. A lot of times it was people I didn't know. And one night, this very tall, good-looking man came backstage after the show, and he said, "Hi, I'm Roger Payne, and I have something for you." And then he handed me a tape, and he said, "I want you to take this home and play it and think about what you'd like to do with it." And Roger had said to me, "This is the first time you will have heard these, and this is the first time the world will have heard this sound."
My name's Roger Payne. I'm best known, I suppose, for having discovered that the sounds that humpback whales make are, in fact, songs. In the summer of 1970, I recorded and then released an album called Songs of the Humpback Whale.
Every time I hear that, I take a deep breath and I'm connected to my heart immediately.
Animal Kingdom kind of vibes.
It reminds me when I was a kid and watching on TV Le Commandant Cousteau, you know?
It's like a broad spectrum of frequencies.
Il y a un fond de moto, et puis après, oui, 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 oui.
God, it's terrifying.
Like water, like the ocean.
It's relaxing and joyful.
It's definitely not relaxing.
What is that? Is it like...
Yeah, and now there's a cat and a car.
Wow.
Magical.
Dolphin.
Magical.
Wee, wee, wee.
And that's real communication. They seem to tell jokes.
It's a language which I don't comprehend.
And the car's still driving.
Just something that wants to be heard.
I was listening to the radio, and somebody announced that the whale had washed ashore in Revere Beach. I thought, oh, I'd love to see what that is like. So I went to Revere Beach. And by the time I arrived, it was late in the day. In fact, it was dark, and it was raining hard. And there was nobody on the beach, so I had a flashlight, and I made my way out looking at the high tide rack to see if I could find the whale. And sure enough, there it was, but it was a porpoise, but it was not what I had imagined I would be seeing. And somebody had cut off its flukes and taken them, and somebody else had carved their initials in the side of this animal, and somebody else had stuffed a cigar butt in its blowhole. And I thought, as I stood in the rain with my flashlight slowly fading for about half an hour, I realized, you know, isn't there some different way that humanity could interact with the wild world than by just desecrating it? And I decided at that point that if I could figure out a way of doing something, that I would.
I'm Willie McKenzie, and I'm an oceans campaigner with Greenpeace. So commercial whaling led to many species of whales being pushed to the very brink of extinction. Over the period of the 20th century, something like 3 million whales were killed by commercial whaling. And it was only about the turn of a century that whaling got really industrialised. The way that the whales were killed was that we went for the biggest ones, which, you know, produced the most, if you like, yield, on the easiest ones to hunt. So that meant that things like right whales, which ironically were the right whales to hunt, and humpback whales were targeted early because they floated and they were a bit fat and they had a lot of blubber. It wasn't until the middle of the 20th century that countries actually got together and started comparing notes and realised how many whales were being killed. Species like the humpback whale, at least 90% of that population disappeared because of commercial whaling.
We were in the late 60s, about 66, and I had taken a job at Rockefeller University and the New York Zoological Society, now the Wildlife Conservation Society, and that was a position that enabled me to do anything I really wanted to do with wild animals, and I thought then maybe the thing I could do is study whales, because it was perfectly clear that they were threatened with extinction from the whaling industry. And so I decided one morning that that's what I was going to do. And later on in that day, there was a meeting at the New York Zoological Society, and I announced that I would spend the rest of my life studying whales.
At the same time, there was a lot of social upheaval going on. There was a lot of other campaigns going on. You know, there was a lot of movement happening.
Vietnam is not our war. We must say no.
Are we going to go? Hell no, we will go.
One of the trustees who was present at that meeting, he had a close friend in Bermuda who was named Frank Watlington, who was a member of the research that went on, sponsored by the U.S. Navy. And they were basically listening for Russian submarines. It was the height of the Cold War. While he was recording, he was hearing some very loud, complicated, complex sounds. And because they were so low in frequency and so loud, he figured, well, they're probably made by whales, but he didn't really know. But he lent me a copy of a tape that he had played, which I heard for the first time with my then wife, Katie Payne, while in the engine room of his research vessel, which was an ex-wooden minesweeper from the Second World War, in fact, the sister ship of Jacques Cousteau's Calypso. And there was a generator that was roaring along, and Frank took a tape out of his pocket, threaded it over the heads of a tape recorder in the corner of the engine room, put on headphones, listened a moment, handed me the headphones, and then almost shouting, he said, "I think these are humpback whales." What I heard under those impossibly awful conditions of listening was the most extraordinary, amazing acoustic performance I'd ever heard from any animal, and have ever heard from any animal since.
They were just unearthly, and yet at the same time very understandable. They sounded very poetic to me. I'm Judy Collins, singer, songwriter, activist, and lyricist. Roger always says that these songs contain all kinds of information that's being shared.
They are the undisputed masters of an incredible vocal performance. I was just thrilled, and Frank said, "Yeah, you can borrow the recording," and gave me a recording. I took it home and started working on it, and then was joined later by Scott McVeigh, one very interested in whales, and Scott analyzed it, and I had analyzed it and discovered as well, oh yes, these animals are repeating themselves. You couldn't listen to them 100 times, which I had done, without realizing that slowly. When an animal makes a sound which is rhythmic and that repeats itself, it is defined as being singing.
I'm Sarah Nikšić. I'm currently doing a PhD in bioacoustics, so I study humpback whale song. Humpback whale songs, they are highly structured. They have a hierarchical structure. The unit is the shortest sound, and then units organized in a specific pattern, they make a phrase, and then phrases combined in a specific order make a theme, and then themes are arranged in a song. Whales often sing these songs one after another in these song sessions that can last for hours, even days.
They are an emotional message, and I felt that it was going to have a profound effect on people. All we had to do is to get it in front, and so I talked to professional musicians, composers, rock stars, actors, priests, anyone who spoke to crowds of people, and I played them these sounds.
Let's see if I can pull them out of my brain. We're bound off for Greenland. Bound off for Greenland, da, 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 to fly here, da, 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 da.
Farewell to Tarwapi, adieu Mormonti.
Whales and Nightingales was released in 1969, and on it contained the singing whales.
I'm bound off for Greenland and ready to sail in hopes to find riches in hunting the whale.
It was a natural fit. The minute I sang the song, and I think it's 5 verses maybe, but the minute I sang the song, it was the same length as what the whale's recording was. I just took it right off of the tape, so the whales start singing, and then I come in and do the song over the whales, mammal to mammal. So what I'm singing is that I'm singing a whaling song. And these guys are going off for probably sometimes 2 or 3 years at a time to kill whales. I mean, that's sad and sorrowful. And they say sometimes a whale lives 100 years. I mean, they live a long time. So they hold a history in their song that we don't really know about, but we seem to imagine what they might know.
Where the icebergs do float and the stormy winds blow, where the land and the ocean is covered with snow.
I live in Fife in Scotland. Across the water is Dundee, which at one point was the centre of the Arctic whaling industry. Also, Scotland was the part of the UK that was the last to finish whaling. In the 60s, some of the last crews that went down to the Antarctic on the big whaling voyages, which generally took a year, they would quite often take people from the northeast of Scotland, young men, to do this effectively factory job on a ship.
But there's no bird in Greenland to sing to the whale.
I had a close friend through music, David Dushkin, who was at the time running a record division for something called CRM Books. And they, for a brief period, had a record division, and they put out one record. And that one record was Songs of the Humpback Whale. Two are Frank Waddington's sounds, and then a whole series of other sounds I had since recorded myself. And it went what we now call viral. what happened was the Geographic eventually got interested in it, and they said, well, we'll put a flexible record into one of our issues. Somebody at the Geographic at some point called up to order this order of records from the Evatone Record Company, and they had to get a record for every one of their members. At the time, they had 10.5 million, so somebody called up Evatone and said, we want 10.5 million copies of this record. And that remains, to this day, by the way, the largest single order in the history of the recording industry. I mean, Michael Jackson, every one of his records outsold the Whale record, but nobody ever called up and said, we want 10.5 million.
For people, it sounded like something from outer space. And then realizing they're not coming from, you know, outer space, but from species living on this planet, made people realize just how little we know of our own planet.
I think it's interesting that it was around the time we landed on the moon, and on the one hand, it's almost a riposte to that. It's like, you know, we're going to the moon, but meanwhile, we're ruining the Earth. But I think it also appeals in the same way as a sort of the same sense of wonder that was caused by the moon landing. It is like, you know, a sort of, you know, we've been taking these giant steps into the beyond. I'm Simon Reynolds, the author of Retromania. It had never been done before, and so it was revelatory, and a lot of musicians were excited about it. Kate Bush used whale sounds on her album, The Kick Inside.
Why don't we put on some music?
No, I need whale song.
The huge reception for Songs of the Humpback Whale kind of fitted into this wider trend of environmental recordings or nature sounds recordings, which were popular. There was a series called Environments by this organisation, Syntonic Research Inc., which would be like a recording of, you know, frogs in a swamp in Georgia, or, you know, an English meadow, a forest at night during a thunderstorm. It happened to coincide with the birth of the Green Movement and more environmental consciousness. And it did become a bit of a New Age cliche and a sort of vague cliche of sort of hippie green consciousness.
This administration is being utterly hypocritical in its attempts to deal with environmental pollution, obviously.
Anti-whaling was one of the first Greenpeace campaigns way back in the start of the 70s. And that, you know, that came from understanding that this was happening, whales were still being killed, and that whales were sentient, engaging animals in the ocean.
The whale's eye was open, so you just pushed the lid and closed its eye.
So there was a joint thing about bringing those images back to land of what was happening at sea, and understanding that these are, you know, animals with a community and a culture of their own. The point then was to try and show, use media and get in between the whaler and the whales to basically say, look, we care about this enough to put ourselves on the line for it and to transmit those images back, because that hadn't been done before. They were not taking on small industry. They were taking on big industry. They were taking on massive Russian boats. Greenpeace was aware of the recordings and of the songs of the whale. And indeed, some of the early Greenpeace voyages used the whale song to play when they were out on the protests.
To this point, we've been dealing with live whales, and everyone was in love with whales, and here's this slaughtered teenage whale lying in the water, and everybody just got, the emotions just got pretty crazy at that stage.
What do you say, Paul? How long do you think it is? How long?
About 18 feet.
I grew up by the sea in Croatia. I learned to swim before I learned to walk. From a really young age, I was involved with music. I went to music school. And I never felt I would be happy with only one of these two worlds. And I didn't want to choose. So then I thought, why not connect these two worlds of mine, like the science and art, and to reach people in a way that is that resonates with them. I just got in touch with some music producers that I met over the years, told them about my idea, and they were really keen to get involved. So the recording I used was made by my supervisor, Dr. Luke Randall, back in 2012 in the Caribbean. So that's actually the first recording analyzed. So it was kind of close to my heart. And I sent the same recording to all the producers. So although the styles vary, like from ambient to down-tempo, sidebass, even some deep techno, you know, there are still the same whale sounds, it's the same inspiration. The album actually resembles the structure of Humpback Whale Song, with each track representing a different theme from the whale song. Whales have been around for much longer than us humans, so compared to them, even the oldest human music is new. Humpback Whale songs, they're really complex and really long, and they constantly evolve, but all the males in the same population sing the same version of the song at any given time. So we have no idea how do they keep up with these changes. Well, we'll see. Maybe at the end of my PhD I'll have some answers. You know, instead of just telling people the mess we made, you know, how badly we treated nature and, you know, how critical the situation is, I'm trying to bring them just to see how amazing it is that there is still so much that we can save, that there is still so much beauty in this world.
I mean, they say the whale campaign on the success of the moratorium or ban on commercial whaling, you know, to this day is possibly the biggest environmental victory globally.
All the Greenpeace is a-sailing, they're crazy as hell. They'd be riding the big ocean in a hollowed-out shell. They'll probably get seasick or they'll probably go blind. They're probably on drugs or at least out of their minds.
It's the first time that countries came together and overturned, if you like, an exploitation organisation, which is what the International Whaling Commission was, which is why it said whaling, not whales, into a conservation organisation. Recording the whale song is such a massive part of making it real, making it engaging, and making it something that people could care about and wanted to care about. You know, we as societies have developed with them, from traversing the ocean and seeing them, to eating them, to burning them down and making them into oil, to having them lubricate our machines and dress us in corsets, and beyond. You know, we've gone beyond that.
I'm bound off for Greenland and ready to sail in hopes to find riches in hunting the whale.
My name is Peter Ducey Motsvelt, and I was born in 1972 in Umanak, up North Greenland. Me and my mom went fishing every day, and the sun is shining, the ducks are waiting. What more could you ask of? We still have people remembering when they were living off hunting, you know. And they can help us with finding our identity because they can tell about, you know, about Greenland from back in the days. I know this 73-year-old guy who his first memory is the sound of water. And he opens his eyes and sees all these women rowing in the Umiak. You know, his first memory, and wow, that's a story, and you know, that's one little story, and that moves me.
Where the icebergs do float and the stormy winds blow, where the land and the ocean is covered with snow.
The final track on the whale record is called Three Whale Trip, and what it comes from was the most pleasant aspect of doing the research that I got to do, and that was you know, you'd go offshore in a boat, sailboat. And humpback whales do most of their singing at night, not in the daytime, although they sometimes sing all day. But what you would do is you'd sail back and forth over the grounds that they were in and towing a hydrophone and making recordings. And there would be three or four people on the sailboat. It's a small sailboat, 34 feet. So what you would do is you'd take turns. And when it became your turn, you would end up sitting in the cockpit, you know, with your foot on the tiller of the boat and steering with one foot and looking up at the mast and watching the mast sweeping across sort of vast fields of stars and listening to these sounds on headphones coming up out of the ocean, just completely echoing. And it just, you can't imagine a more extraordinarily powerful feeling. And one particular night, we just got a whales that were making some of the most beautiful sounds. There's a Chinese proverb that has moved me all my life that I think is the very thing that humanity needs to keep in mind now. And it goes, go to the center of the danger, for there you shall find safety. And I think that is exactly what humanity has to do now. We have to go to the center of the danger of our terrible problems that we're facing and make the changes that are necessary, for there we shall find safety. And I would add, only there.
Thank you for listening. There will be more from the documentary podcast soon. The documentary is just one of our BBC World Service podcasts. There are many others to choose from.
Hi, I'm Catty Kay.
And I'm Carlos Watson.
I'm a journalist and host for BBC World News based in Washington, D.C.
And I'm an entrepreneur and journalist based in California.
Which is rather what I'd like to be instead. Together, we are the hosts of a brand new podcast called When Catty Met Carlos.
You know, at this crucial time in American history, we're going to be picking apart some of the issues that are facing the country right now. When Catty Met Carlos.
From the BBC World Service.
And Aussie Media. Just search for When Catty Met Carlos wherever you get your podcasts.